Good afternoon. We greet you in the name of Christ. It's been good to be with you again this weekend. Although the title on the program is Brotherhood, Caring, and Sharing, I have been asked to speak specifically to the subjects of financial distresses, special needs, widows, and elderly. I'm going to be up front, and I'm going to be speaking on a subject close to my heart, and I'm going to warn you right up front that I take after my father. I look more like my mother, maybe natured in some ways like my mother, but my mother is very stoic, and she can talk about anything. She doesn't even cry at, she didn't even cry at my father's funeral. And my dad, he had a hair trigger, and it just welled up so easily in him, and I have a hair trigger, and I wished I didn't. I wish I had a little stiffer spring like some of you do. I saw Floyd has a pretty stiff spring, and he can talk about these things, and I envy people like that that can talk so easily about subjects like this, and I've kind of learned where my territory is, and I try to stay away from that trigger, but I can't today. It's all over it. So bear with me. It'll take me a little bit of time. I want to start with a scripture in Acts 2, if you'd care to turn with me to that. I'm just to paint a general picture here. I'm not going to go through this scripture necessarily. I'm trying to paint a picture here to get a setting for us to stand on this morning as we this afternoon as we talk about these subjects here. Acts 2, 41 to 47. We have a new church here. And they that gladly received his word were baptized, and the same day there were added unto them about 3,000 souls. And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship and in breaking of bread and in prayers. And fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done by the apostles. And all that believed were together and had all things common, and sold their possessions and goods, and parted them to all men, as every man had need. And they continuing daily with one accord in the temple, and breaking bread, from house to house did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved. And I imagine a lot of the reason that the church grew so rapidly in those days was because of the is because of the aura that surrounded this brotherhood fellowship. And as they gathered together, it was just like a magnet to draw people in. Before I go farther, I want to make a commitment to you. Last evening, some of my family members warned me to watch the time. And so I want to make a commitment to you. I want to show the same urgency in to stop talking and sit down as what you did when it was time to start the service this afternoon. Is that fair enough? I realize this is a difficult time to stay awake, and I've already said I've lost a little sleep preparing this message. It won't hurt you to lose a little listening to it, but I want to be understanding too, because I fight that at times too. Well, I was going to say that at the beginning, but let's define brotherhood next here. Brotherhood is an association of men united in a common interest, work, creed, such as a fraternity or religious order or labor union. It's a belief in, or it's a feeling of unity and cooperation among men or among all people. Then a more modern definition, more of an urban definition, is a friendship unlike any other, built out of respect and love that will always have each other's backs. And someone has said that friends have each other in their contact list, brothers have each other in their emergency contacts. So we gather from those definitions that brotherhoods are close, and they have at least one thing in common, and that's they are unified and they are cooperative in their endeavors, and they trust each other to cover their backs. So I looked up, what's covering your back? Well, I mean, we know what it means, but I looked it up, and it says, having someone's back is an idiomatic expression, meaning that you're watching out for that person, basically taking care and protecting that person from harm. Isn't that beautiful to have each other's backs instead of stabbing each other in the back? or saying things and doing things behind our backs. The late George Bush, I shouldn't say late president, I should say, still living, George Bush Sr., he plugged for a kinder and gentler society. And I think that's what we look for in our brotherhoods, a kinder and gentler society, and especially as we look into the needs that we're looking at this morning, it's so important that we have a kind and gentle brotherhood. As we look at financial distresses, widows, the elderly, special needs, you know, we're looking at people that have some, we're looking at people that have some degree of special need and a degree of vulnerability. And there are times that these tend to be cause and effect with each other. Physical and emotional problems can cause financial distress, and financial distress may cause physical or emotional problems, and even spiritual problems. And God, in His wisdom, has chosen to put some people into these categories. God in His wisdom has chosen to make people dependent upon others. Sometimes people put themselves into these categories. Sometimes other people put people into these categories. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to special needs. I'd like to begin, though, with the financially distressed. Now, the causes of financial distress are myriad, but obviously the underlying cause is that our outlay exceeds our income. It's pretty simple. You know, and it may be a result of disappointing sales, excessive expenses, unforeseen economic changes, shifts in consumer preferences, destructive storms, accidents, health issues, incompetence, in other words, ignorance of what you're trying to do, procrastination, poor work habits. The Bible would call it slothfulness. Constantly changing jobs, competition, poor interpersonal relationship skills, and the list could go on. You know, there's a lot of risk in all areas of life, and we must assume at least a measure of it. There's a picture I think my son-in-law has had already up, and it shows a young man with a basketball hoop in front of him. It's quite a ways away. But anyway, it says on there, you'll never make the shot you don't take. So it's meant to be an inspirational one. But so there is a degree of risk in business. And that was covered in the Anabaptist Financial Seminar here by Brother Greg Wolf. And we can monitor it. In other words, we can try to track it. We can try to manage it, and we can even assume, we can even pay someone to assume that risk for us, which is called insurance, and people try to do that. But there still is risk that you can't pay someone else to take in your life. And I think he said in his presentation that, you know, there's a lion in the streets. There's a lion in the streets. It's too big of a risk to go out in the street today. Well, Brother Lester Miller, who also used to do financial seminars, spoke to that. And he said, yeah, there's a lion in the street. There's a lion in the street. It's too dangerous to go out. And so they just lie in bed all day. And they get restless and they start kicking around and they hit the bedpost and they break their toe. And so there's even risk to doing nothing. So there are risks in our life, and we must assume some risk. And so I'm not saying that it's wrong for someone to assume a financial risk. There's a sense in which, speaking about the financially distressed area here this morning, is the easiest, and there's a sense in which it's the most difficult. It's the easiest in the sense that the solution is mathematical. We know that the income must be greater than or equal to the expenses. You've probably heard about the two fellows that had this business. They lived in Indiana, and they had a truck, and they would go up into Michigan, and they would buy chickens for a dollar a piece. they would haul these chickens down to Indiana and they would sell them for a dollar a piece. And after a while, the one looked at the other and he says, you know, we're not making any money. And the other one looked at him, he says, I know, we need a bigger truck. And sometimes we're about that illogical. We like what we're doing. And we want to keep doing it. And maybe it'll get better. But for some reason, it doesn't. I asked different brethren for some advice, and one said from another congregation, he says that what can make this situation very difficult is when people are unworkable. And then he went on to say, and often that is why they are in the situation in the first place, is because they are unworkable. I told our congregation at home I had Wednesday evenings last month, and I told them that I was assigned this subject of special needs and elderly and widows and financial distresses. And I said, now, three of them, I said, I feel I have some experience in. But I said, the other one, financial distresses, you really haven't given me much experience in. So I want your help and advice for situations like this. And most of their advice tend to be in the preventing it from happening in the first place, but I'll give some of those and then some others that I've gleaned and come up with. One was to get good advice. Get some from professionals in the financial world, even if they're not in the church. You may even need to bring in professionals. And the advantage of doing that is that serves as a neutral party, and it gives a degree of competence and respectability. And a person will sometimes take things from a stranger that they won't take from a neighbor or a brother. Get it from multiple persons. And get it from some that you think will disagree with you. You know, that's true of any area of life. When we ask advice, also ask advice from people that will probably say what you need. Not, how did Brother Joseph say that this morning? That will say what you need, not what you want to hear. Don't just get it, follow it. I've already said that, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I've already said that I would make a terrible counselor, because if I gave someone some advice and then the next time we got together to give them advice, I'd say, did you do what I told you to last time? And they said no, and I'd say, well, what are you doing here again? You got to follow advice if you're going to get advice, if you need advice. Well, that may be an oversimplification, but there's also a truth there. Get advice and then follow it. Look at the history of the type of enterprise in which you're engaged. And don't think that you can defy all the odds and make a go of it when every break would have to go in your favor. This one's from the Farmer's Almanac. If you're in a hole, stop digging. Know where you are. Keep your books and keep your checkbook and balance sheet up to date, so you can see which way it's trending in the long term. I remember I used to hate to balance my check. I like math, but I hated to balance my checkbook because I know I'd always get an unpleasant jolt at the end. There wouldn't be as much in there as what I thought there was or what I needed maybe. And nowadays with computers and so on, it's a little easier to stay up tight behind it and don't tend to get those. But nevertheless, be realistic and know where you are. All businesses have their ups and downs and may even lose money some years, but you know, watch that long term. You can chart things nowadays with computers. You can chart things, and then you can put in a trend line. And even though the line goes like this, it'll put a line in there that shows if it's going up, going down. I would encourage that even more, good bookkeeping and staying up to date when things are tight. Avoid multiple credit cards and the snare of easy credit. And that's a very prevalent one. And that's a good place to start digging, is stop running up your credit cards if you're losing ground. Cut them up or freeze them in a container of water. And I've heard that advice given, like in a bread pan or something. Freeze them in the middle of a bread pan full of water, and then maybe by the time it thaws and you can use it, you'll have changed your mind. I'm going to tell you a real life story here. Maybe you can relate to it. I knew a brother who went to get a loan one time. He'd always had easy time getting loans, and the banker really drew in, and he wondered why. My brother wondered why, and he said, "Your credit card debt's too high." And he says, "No." He says, "You owe about $80,000." And he says, "No, I don't." So they looked, and he did. I mean, that was his wake-up call. He got down to business, set it up on payments, and in 5 years he had paid every penny back. And today he will not use a credit card. He will only use a debit card. If you're called in to help someone, be humble and avoid being smug or flexing your muscle if you're asked to help. Be confidential. You know, there are people who may be very slow to come out with some pretty sensitive information if they feel that it's going to be spread all over the community. It's scriptural for those who have abilities and wisdom to advise others. And so if you're asked to help someone in a situation like this, by all means help, even though it'd be easier not to. If you need help, ask for it before it becomes harder to resolve. If the way the church finds out about it is because the businesses in the community businessmen in the community start complaining about it, That's too late. It's not too late to resolve it, but it should have been dealt with before this. The church should provide teaching on finances. The Bible has much to say about it, and let's be faithful in giving teaching in it. I have this definition of financial insolvency, and I'm going to read it, just a paragraph. Upon becoming insolvent, immediate action must be taken to rectify the situation as soon as possible in order to avoid possible bankruptcy by generating cash, minimizing overhead costs, cutting back on living expenses, and settling or renegotiating current debts and debt repayments. And I give that because that's what people, even in the world, are asked to do. You have to cut back. And people push back against that, changing their lifestyle. They're planning to build a new house, and now they have hospital bills. Does that mean they can't build a house? Can't you pay the hospital and I build my house? Well, I've said already, I think it's a poor policy to go ahead with a major construction of your own when the church is helping you pay hospital bills. I just think the timing is poor there. People can get upset and push back, and they may even throw their checkbooks. I say that because one brother told me he knows of a situation where they were helping somebody, and they kept putting more pressure on him because he wasn't cooperating, and finally the fellow just took and he just threw his checkbook at him, and it landed over across the room on the floor, and nobody went and picked it up. But he says, "Yeah, you take it and do it then." What an attitude. Let's be preemptive and let's open our checkbooks to the care and wisdom of the brotherhood. And before we know it, we can pass this chapter in our lives. And I'm past that chapter in my sermon now too, so have a little competition here, I realize, and I don't blame you. Let's go on to special needs now. Let's go to Exodus chapter 4. There's a verse that was pointed out to us after our Down son was born 31 years ago by my sister-in-law, and it's been a special verse to us since that time, to my wife and I. Exodus 4, and this is when Moses was trying to get out of going and speaking to Pharaoh and making all types of excuses, and then God told him in Exodus 4 in verses 10 and 11, "And Moses said unto the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither there heretofore nor since Thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. And the Lord said unto him, Who hath made man's mouth? Or who maketh the dumb, or deaf, or the seeing, or the blind? Have not I the Lord? There may be people that have very obvious physical problems, such as missing limbs or disfiguration. There may be Down syndrome or many other syndromes that have very easy to detect physical clues. And then there may be something more of a mental or a social nature, such as schizophrenia, bipolar, FAS, which is fetal alcohol syndrome, autism, OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, ADHD, attention deficit disorder, and hyperactive type there. And so often, the ones that people can see, they're understanding and sympathetic with. Yeah, they know. They can tell by looking at him that he has this, and they know how these type of people act, and they know there's different degrees of it, and they don't have a problem with that and accepting it. Then some of the others that are more behavioral, that are more mental, and maybe that come and go, such as bipolar. You know, one day you're fine, and the next day you're not. And then people suddenly don't quite understand it, and they label it as other things. That child isn't hyper. He doesn't have ADD. He needs discipline. And it is very hard at times to know where the line is. And so we need to be very careful in making judgments without knowing the facts. Especially when people seem totally normal to us, and you only need to know them very well before you can understand that some of these conditions exist. A congenital disorder is a medical condition that is present at or before birth. These conditions are referred to as birth defects, can be acquired during the fetal stage of development or from the genetic makeup of the parents. And they may develop some social issues from the environment in which they live, or they may acquire mental problems from the abuse of drugs, either by themselves or by their mother while she carried them, which is where they get FAS. And it may be the result of accidents that are our own fault. For instance, Eutychus, I mean, come on, shouldn't he have known better to be sitting in a third-story window when he's sleeping? When he's sleepy. Well, he was even killed doing that, but he was brought back to life, so I guess we can say that one had a happy ending, but so many don't. There may be accidents that are the result of someone else's carelessness, such as Mephibosheth. And he was lame because he was dropped by his nurse as she was fleeing with him. And so the point is that whether it's temporary or lifelong, whether or not we know whose fault it is as it is, and we go on from here. That's where we are. You know, agape love and phileo love are both present in the brotherhood. And so we approach it as doing it out of a desire. As Paul told the Ephesians, he said, and this is my definition, this is my biblical definition of agape love. I kept back nothing that was profitable unto you. I kept back nothing that was profitable unto you. I think that's the best definition, concise definition I can find in the Bible of agape love. Holding back nothing that is profitable to someone else, you know, regardless of the cost to us. These people may sometimes cramp our lifestyle, and depending on what their issues are that make them special, and some may have very little to offer in return for our service and our expenditures on their behalf. And there's others who return much appreciation and love, and others are often uncooperative and antagonistic. But let's understand that we need these people among us. They help us to learn compassion and patience and simplicity in working without financial compensation, with putting the needs of others ahead of ourselves and our desires, and maybe even humility. And so I have just a few practical observations for this. For one thing, we must put the same value on them as we put on our other children. If we're going to spend X number of dollars on one child for a certain thing, would we spend the same on them? Another one is they will always be children, at least in some sense. They'll always be children, at least in some sense. We can tease them as it's appropriate, but we must not mock them. We must not mock them. As far as the four groups I'm talking about today, I believe this one is the most diverse. And so I think we need to learn what others have discovered about these challenges and minister to them in a way that fits their unique needs. There's a lot of people with advice out there, some's good and some not so good, but let's be diligent to do our homework and seek these things out. Most of these people like to get attention. Excuse me. Like to get attention. So let's give them enough, but let's not allow them to expect to always be the center of attention. Let's not be embarrassed. Let's not be embarrassed. I have a story I want to tell you here. We have Menards in our area that we do a lot of our shopping at. It's like a Home Depot or a Lowe's, whatever you're used to. But my mother and father-in-law were staying with us one winter. My father-in-law was in construction. He was about 90 years old. But he liked to go along to Menards, and he could get around quite well. So if we were going to Menards in the evening after supper, he liked to go along. Sometimes it got a little bit late. My mother-in-law had Alzheimer's, and at this point in her life, she really didn't even know us or her husband. And it was a little difficult to move her, but after some effort, we could get her in and out of vehicles. And so they decided that they wanted to ride along with us to Menards that evening, and we had two children of our own. We had our down son, Russell, with us, and we had our young daughter along with us. And so they were getting in the pickup. We had a two-seater pickup, and they were getting in the pickup, and here Russell didn't show up. And so I went to look for Russell, and here he was standing in the basement. And I said, "Russell, you have to come now." And I took him, and we got him out in the pickup. And so we got to Menards, and we stop in front of the door, and we have this big scene of getting the doors open and getting a wheelchair and struggling to get Grandma out of the wheelchair, out of the vehicle and into the wheelchair. Excuse me. And then Grandpa would push her around, and you thought he was pushing Miss America around. He just had such a smile on his face, and he was proud to do it. Well, then Russell and I went and parked the pickup, and then I got him out, and we came across the parking lot. It was late spring. There was a little snow on the ground, and it was melting some. It was a little wet, and he wasn't coming very good. And I said, "Come on, you have to come." And I went back and gave him a pull, and he made the funniest hops. And then I looked down, and here he didn't have any shoes on. I drug him out so fast he hadn't had time to put his shoes on. So I didn't have any choice but to go into the Menards store and get another wheelchair, and we pushed him around that night. So I felt we made quite a spectacle as we did our shopping that night. And you know, I think he liked it very well. I think he'd like to shop that way at Menards all the time. But you know, they're just, that's the way it is. People are kind and understanding, and we just do what we need to do. We call them special, and let's act like it. My wife was reading a children's story about parents taking their children to Jesus to be healed. And she wondered, what are all the things these children are getting healed of? And then she got to pondering what she would do if she had the opportunity to take our son to Jesus. And she decided that if she had the opportunity to take our son to Jesus, she'd pass on it. Next, let's go to widows. 1 Timothy 5, verses 3 through 6. Honor widows that are widows indeed. But if any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. Now she that is a widow indeed, and desolate, trusteth in God and continueth in supplications and prayers night and day. But she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth. I'd like to read that in a different translation. The International Standard Version. Honor widows that have no other family members to care for them. Thank you. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, they must first learn to respect their own family by repaying their parents. Now notice it didn't say children or nephews. It says children or grandchildren, which is the proper interpretation of that word or translation. And instead of requiting their parents, it says by repaying their parents. For this is pleasing in God's sight. A woman who has no other family members to care for her and who is left all alone and has placed her hope in God and devotes herself to petitions and prayers night and day, but the self-indulgent widow is just as good as dead. Normally, widows have families, and families have the first responsibility. We just read that. Especially in helping with her transition from a married life to a single life. She may have known she was going to become a widow if her husband had a lingering illness, or it could be thrust very suddenly upon her if he died suddenly. And there are some that may be widows through desertion, and so I guess they aren't technically widows, and yet, for all practical purpose, from a brotherhood perspective, they are. And that's even more difficult to help them deal with that rejection. You know, the scripture I just read refers to financial care, and that's often one of the first things that needs to be addressed. And possibly it's even the easiest in some respects. Because we're talking about a brotherhood. So if it's just the income that's missing, maybe that's the easiest part to supply. And so the family, we as families need to rally around and give emotional support and lend a listening ear and replace that ear that's gone now, but one that she needs. God has expectations about how we are to treat widows. And it says in Psalm 68:5 in the New King James Version that He will be their defender. I would really not want to be found guilty of mistreating someone who's when God is their defender. I'd like to read Exodus 22, 23 through 24. You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise and they cry unto me at all, I will surely hear their cry. And my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. Brother Lester Troyer used to say that the Pharisees used to look for opportunities with the widows. They looked for opportunities to rob them and to take advantage of them, to consume or devour their houses, I think the Bible says. I haven't seen an abuse of widows in a financial means, but rather, I've seen more of a generous outpouring to meet their needs. But some practical suggestions dealing with widows. First of all, what are the first needs that come to mind? And it may vary with the widow, but maybe there's a mountain of hospital bills if the spouse died of an accident or a disease, and those need to be taken care of as outlined in the previous scripture, the family first and afterwards the brotherhood. There's the ongoing financial needs of the widow. And so the situation has to be explored. They need to sit together with the family. Or the family needs to open up at this time and be very forthright. Older teenagers may need to do more of the breadwinning than what they were used to, and maybe more than their peers need to do. But let's not expect them to completely give up their own lives and not be able to do some of the things that are available to them only at that time in life. I would encourage eliminating debt as soon as possible, especially for housing. If there are children that's still at home, they may need a father figure, and some older brother, uncle, grandfather, or even a good family friend will need to step up and be that family, that father figure for them. Again, they're not a father, but they're a father figure. Remember, it is what it is, and we go on for here. Time heals and painful memories fade. And let's just accept that this is our reality for now, for today, and move on one day at a time. My wife and I have watched this happen 6 times just in our parents and our siblings. Let's reach out and not assume because they have a smile on their face in a couple months that they aren't hurting. And don't be surprised if they shed some tears, especially during singing, because that seems to be a tender time. That's often when the waves roll over them. Children, if a new relationship develops, be very understanding and even supportive. One of our key learnings, you know, as we went to both my wife's father and my mother remarried after her mother and my father died. And one of her key learnings here, is that the second time is very much like the first time. They express the same emotions, and it's hard on us to say. It's hard on children sometimes to hear them say, "I'm just as excited as I was the first time." What? They don't look very romantic to me. It's just as romantic as my dad or my mom, you know, and whatnot. But anyway, to them, it's real. And you that have been in those shoes would testify to that. And we need to be supportive and understanding of that. You will be surprised sometimes how your parents will act so much like they used to tell you not to act, I guess, to be real honest. That was one of my key learnings. Let's move on to the elderly. You know, up until this point, we've discussed situations in which there was a major accident or an unfortunate event. But, you know, not everyone has accidents. Not everyone maybe has unfortunate events like this. And so maybe you've lived a charmed life, and all the bread that you've dropped has always landed with the butter up. And you've had your near misses in life, but never any hits. By the way, that term near misses is an official term. I remember when our safety director started talking about near misses, and I'm like, "What do you mean near misses? You either miss or you hit." I said, "If you have a near miss, that means you get hit." But actually, if you look it up, it's an official OSHA term. A near miss is something when the potential was there for harm or danger, and it was missed. And so they call that a near miss. So you come to life and you're healthy and you haven't had any hits. They've been near misses. But you know what? You're still going to get old. There's no getting away. You're either going to have one of the others we talked about, or you're going to get old. So we're getting elderly actually as a result of a good life. But it still happens. There's a transition that the senior has taken, and you know, we may underestimate how difficult it is when our aged parents undergo this transition. One thing that has made an impact on my life, and it was told kind of in a humorous way, but there's some real truth to it, and I'd like to share it with you. I'm sure many of you I have already. But some of you may have known Andrew Kaufman from Sheldon. And as he was older and he was a widower. I think he was a widower at the time. And his children were taking him from place to place if he had to go somewhere. And one time after I was standing close there after a service or something, and they were discussing how they were going to, somebody's going to take him or pick him up and take him, drop him off here. Somebody else was going to take him from there. I forget exactly how it was, but they were having this discussion among themselves, and he was kind of standing on the edge. After a while, he turns to me, and he gave me kind of a wry smile, and he says, "You know, I used to be the parent of seven children, and now I'm the child of seven parents." And you know, there's a lot of truth to that statement. I repeated it often to my mom when she was younger, and my father-in-law, because we have to realize that the Bible says, like it does in Peter, that someday somebody's going to pick us up and take us places we don't especially want to go. And we need to be cooperative. But on the other hand, we need to be understanding then. My father-in-law, and I'm talking pretty plainly here. My father-in-law did not receive Social Security, and he did not have funds available to him, and so he lived with us as a dependent. And so he had a bedroom in our house, and he stuck his feet right under our table, and he was okay with that. I don't think it would have been his first choice, but eventually he got so used to that he did well with that. On the other hand, so he lived with us the last 3.5 years of his life, and the last 7 years, my mother has her own apartment that was built for her in our house, and she lives there, and she is fiercely independent. If we buy her a loaf of bread and a half a gallon of milk, we can't leave the room until she gets out her money and pays us for it. And she is just fiercely independent. And so I say that to say what two types of people we can there. And so can we minister to both of them? I hope that we can. And so be understanding in those ways. My mother, although she likes to be independent, she also likes to feel protected. And sometimes I think she wishes that we'd fuss more over her. I know one time she went on a trip with my cousin and her husband, and he's a bishop. He's a bishop in the church there, Nationwide Church there in Wisconsin. And she went to Canada to a wedding with them, and she asked us, "Should I call you when we get there?" Well, we thought she was in pretty good hands. That wasn't too necessary. But she actually wanted me to say, yes, you should call me. Because she wanted to feel protected and missed. Seniors feel themselves weakening, and they feel themselves becoming more helpless and vulnerable. They need support, both physical and emotional. They like things light. And so we need to keep them warm. We need to keep them lit up, need to keep light. When we were working on that apartment for my mom, we always knew what color she wanted, the lightest color available. Do you want maple or oak cabinet? She said, which is lighter? Well, maple. She said, I want maple. She didn't have any clue on what they look like. And so we need to realize that seniors, we need to have handrails up. That's so frightening to them to stand at the top or bottom of a stairway and not have handrails and not be... They don't need to be in their 90s before they get to that. To a child, love is spelled T-I-M-E, and sometimes with seniors or most anyone else. Seniors may need spiritual nourishment. Some put a high priority in making it to services, and some don't. And we realize that my mother was not getting the spiritual nourishment that she should, and so we began having our evening devotions with her, and that's meant so much to her, and it has meant a lot to us too. It's good for both of us, because we're at the age in life where it can be very easy to get too busy with just a couple of us to sit down for devotions. Seniors may have become cynical or bitter or critical, and let's not assume that just because they're old and been a member of church all their life that they're ready to die. Let's make sure they are. Is there some long-standing bitterness that needs to be taken care of yet? Maybe they've stuffed it inside of themselves all their lives and it needs to be made right. Trust that's not the situation. Have a plan in place for their death and their burial and their estate. Larry Burkett, who is a financial evangelical financial planner, and he recommends that there's only enough left in the estate to pay so that their last check goes to pay the funeral home and that check bounces. I think he was making a point to us, don't you? I think he was. Then there'll be no fights. I've had two non-plane people sit in my office in the last year and tell me about their parent dying and how some of the family members were grasping for the money, and if they wanted it, they can just have it. Shame on us Christians to take that they would have that attitude if we don't. So in a general way, to cover all the last three, let's just encourage each other. And I'm encouraged by those of you who have ministered so faithfully to your unique situations. I watch families who have a handicapped child or a sibling or a widowed elderly parent, and I find your patient and loving and sacrificial care for them to be contagious. When our son was born, you know, I sat down with the children and I explained to them, you know, you're going to have to watch your brother get mocked. And now 31 years later, I can say I haven't seen it even once. The two congregations that we've been a part of since that time have both been wonderful, as well as our children and grandchildren. We felt so at home when we joined this fellowship, and as we began attending these meetings, and we saw others with very similar situations. Russell has more preacher friends than any other kind of friends. And I told our older boys that if they're somewhere and people don't know who they are, just tell them that they're Russell's brother. He lost a good friend when Brother Steve died. We would be at fellowship meetings or ministers' meetings, and when we were going to get in the lunch line, we'd ask where Russell was, and someone would say, well, he already went through with Steve. And Brother Steve isn't the only one. There are some of you sitting here that have done the same thing. That's the beautiful thing about brotherhood. I want to take a little time now to honor those who have made impressions on my life as I watch them care for others. I want to kind of follow a Hebrews 11 format here. I want to honor my wife, who besides having a special needs child of her own, has and is giving end-of-life care to three of our four parents. She's also been the rock that a couple of her sisters have leaned on a couple years ago when their lives hit rock bottom with traumatic and humiliating events in their family's lives. She's even been sought out by people who are outside our family and has never said no. I want to honor my co-minister and his wife, who one day were expecting the joy of welcoming. They have two daughters, and they were welcoming the youngest daughter's second grandchild one day. They found out that she was going, and she had gone in. And instead of that, in a few days later, they looked down into a casket that had one of their two daughters and their grandson that they had never met, really, lying in it. I want to honor my brother in the Lord, and neighbor who has so lovingly and patiently dealt with so many things of this nature in his own family, so often with ingratitude and criticism and so seldom with appreciation. I'd like to honor my cousin who had cared for her grandmother in her last years, cared for our grandmother in the last years of her life, even though grandma lived to be 100 years old and didn't know she was being taken care of or could show appreciation. I want to honor another cousin who took care of my aunt and her mother, even when her mother had Alzheimer's, and it was a very difficult journey, and she was faithful to the end. Not only these, but their husbands and their families. I want to honor the first special needs that I remember, and through the years I have watched the Bear family care for their Downs brother, as well as a widowed mother. I respect and honor the three Miller families from this community who have cared for or are caring for their special family members as well as elderly widows. I honor two families in Iowa who have taken in those who need a place to live, even though they are not blood relation. I honor those who are working hard to adopt children with special needs, knowing the cost. I honor those who lovingly care for those in wheelchairs or on crutches, or who spoon feed their father or mother, or care for those whose needs are not seen in public, like public settings like this, but they're there in private life. I honor the in-laws who treat their spouse family members as their own. I want to honor the church families who have stood behind everyone with encouragement, help, spelling off and giving care to give the caregivers a break, and who have also given financial support. You know, I want to honor the many others who I may not know or should have mentioned, who by love and with a sense of duty, they sacrifice personal agenda and time. They show love when love is not returned. They stay home when they would like to go. They spend time while traveling, getting people in and out of vans and restrooms. They listen to stories many times over, and in general show that they will hold back nothing that is profitable to them. May God bless you all with the highest reward at the end of life's journey. It will be worth it all. I'd like to finish by reading a poem that's a song by Elizabeth Drudge. It would have been nice if our men's group could have sung this one for us this morning as well. Would we truly long for heaven if this life was perfect here? If we had no pain or heartache? If we never shed a tear? If we had no disappointments and our dreams would not come true? Could we keep that heavenly vision and that deep eternal view? Would we truly long for heaven if we never gave a sigh? If the old were always taken and the young would never die? If we had no cherished loved ones waiting at the eastern gate, would we truly long for heaven and reunion that awaits? Would we truly long for heaven at the ending of the road if our backs were never bleeding from the burden of the load? If the sun was always shining, if we never felt a gale, would we long for heaven's harbor to be safe within the veil? Would we truly long for heaven and the bliss of yonder shore if we had no loved ones tugging on the line at heaven's door? If our precious family circle ne'er was broken here below, would we truly long for heaven where our loved ones we shall know? Yes, dear Savior, we are longing to be safe on heaven's shore, and these trials only make us long for heaven more and more. And we see that thou art using every trial of each day as a tug from heaven's anchor just to pull us heaven's way. The Lord bless you.